Before we launch into this very special episode of the Partially Examined Life, I've got a couple announcements. We are now offering transcriptions, both on the previous episode on Nietzsche and this one on Voltaire. A substantial portion of each of these can be read at partiallyexaminedlife.com for free, and we encourage you to purchase the full transcription. Whether we make more of these will depend entirely on how many people buy them. On the evening of September 23rd, we're going to have our first Partially Examined Life audience participation discussion section. A select dozen of you will join a couple of the podcasters to discuss the topic of the previous podcast, Nietzsche's Truth and Lie essay. Please take a look at partiallyexaminedlife.com for details. Finally, I want to remind you that the Partially Examined Life is listener-supported. Please consider a donation of a dollar or more at partiallyexaminedlife.com/donate. You're listening to Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 62 is something like, is life good? We read Candide or Optimism, the philosophical novel by Voltaire from 1759. You can join the discussion, get the text, read loads of supplemental material at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lindenmeyer.
You normally say broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin.
We can just all say our names, and then we can...
Well, what if we all say from in Madison?
Yes.
This is Mark Lindenmeyer, speaking to you from Madison, Wisconsin.
And this is Seth Paskin, coming to you from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn, visiting Madison, Wisconsin.
And this is Dylan Casey in Madison, Wisconsin.
So why the hubbub? Why the strange locale?
Well, the hubbub is about the fact that after 3.5 years of doing this podcast, this will be the first time that we are all simultaneously present in the same room at the same time. Dylan and I are meeting each other for the first time in person, and Wes and Mark and I are seeing each other. I am seeing them for the first time in, I believe, 15 years.
Yep.
In person.
Yeah, and this is my first time meeting Dylan as well.
And therefore, it's my first time meeting Wes and Seth.
QED.
Our first time that we can make gestures at each other that you, the listeners, cannot hear. We can say, open a ho-ho. And other people can say, what the hell are you doing opening a ho-ho?
This is the first time I've actually done the podcast with clothing on. And sober.
Certainly at least one of those things is ditto for me.
I'm suppressing the joke that I would want to make that is too obscene for this crowd.
Well, you can edit it out. That's weird.
That normally the energy in the show comes from being able to climax at a certain point. Oh, but yet,
God. I'm eating a ho-ho.
I might have a joke to follow that up, but I don't think it would be very flattering or appropriate either. So let's move on.
So, Candide. Is this even a work of philosophy? Why are we bothering to do this?
Yeah, how did we end up doing this?
Yeah, who suggested this?
Yeah, whose idea was it?
I believe we were looking for something that we could prepare quickly. That was the idea. And I put forth a few suggestions, and Wes was very excited about this one. So we had to do this. But it was fun.
Yeah, I was excited to do a work of fiction. But how did you end up suggesting?
It was something, you know, I think it was in a philosophy class rather than like a great books class, but I had read this a long time ago and just didn't remember that much about it. I know a few people have recommended we cover Voltaire. And so it got in my mind. It seems especially apropos since we just did McIntyre in his contra-enlightenment thing to actually read somebody who represents the Enlightenment. Nobody represents the Enlightenment like Voltaire. Mm-hmm. He was skating the trends. He was the man. Descartes and Newton and those guys might have actually produced the substance, but Voltaire, he was the style.
Well, yeah, and he has got a certain kind of... not merely embracing relationship with the Enlightenment, right? If Descartes' a member of the Enlightenment, he's certainly no friend to Descartes in that respect.
Yes.
Right. He defended the new Newtonian mechanics against the old Cartesian and, to some extent, Leibnizian mechanics, although those are very different things.
And I didn't really ever understand what the substance of that debate was. Do we even want to try to address it in a couple sentences?
I think some of it has to do with the idea of gravity being action at a distance. I think for early mechanics, I think Descartes and others embraced the intuitive idea that for bodies to act on each other, they had to be touching. And so if you couldn't see them actually touching each other and imposing force on each other that way, it worked through the ether, through some sort of hydraulics or fluid mechanics, let's say. I'm not really sure of the details.
Vortex. Okay. Vortices.
Okay, vortices. So Newton just said, no, it's action at a distance, and we don't need these hypotheses about these intermediate causal factors or mechanisms like vortices.
Newton explicitly says, I solve this problem, but I'm not going to really worry about what the fundamental metaphysics of it is. So part of the reason for the insistence on things touching, and for someone like Descartes, was a kind of metaphysical predisposition to have causes accounted for differently than Leibniz would do it. But nonetheless, explicitly requiring the cause. Whereas Newton, it says, well, they act at a distance. It acts in this way. I can show it rationally, mathematically. There's more to be said about it, but I'm not going to really worry about it. I should have brought my Principia.
No, you should not have brought your Principia.
There's a very famous quote about this in Newton.
Something like, I offer no hypothesis.
That is exactly what it is. I offer no hypothesis.
Yeah.
And so that's either scandalous or brilliant. Depending on what you think. In some ways, it's pragmatic. In some ways, it's the beginning of the worst part of science and sort of not being worried about efficient things. Or only being worried about efficient things. And also the sort of very pragmatic part of science, which says, I'm going to try to solve this problem. And if I have to sort it out later, I'll sort it out later.
Well, it's sort of, it's a movement away from worrying about mechanisms specifically, right?
Metaphysical mechanisms.
Yeah. So you have these bodily movements that are correlated, and you can write equations for that, and that's your science. And you, if you can't really do anything empirically to establish a mechanism, then you have to forget about that. Leibniz is actually a whole different can of worms, because he invented the calculus simultaneously with Newton, and he made great contributions to science, including kinetic energy. But Leibniz still wanted to talk about the metaphysical basis, say, of kinetic energy, which he called vis viva. So Leibniz was still wedded to this early rationalist speculation that was part of science then. And with Newton, you're getting away from that. And I think that's what Voltaire embraces, this sort of hardline empiricist approach.
All right. Well, to celebrate getting rid of action at a distance, and because my wife is down here taking pictures, which you can see on the website, I must come over to you and strike you.
What am I supposed to do in response to that?
You're supposed to say, ouch. You're supposed to say, here's the picture.
Ow.
I'm just wondering if anybody has ever uttered the phrase before, I should have brought my Principia with me.
Come to St. John's.
All right. But the thing that we came to talk about today was the Candide. Was his ethical philosophy, his view on philosophy, for one thing.
Or one particular philosopher, at least.
Yes. His objection to Descartes and Leibniz. Leibniz in particular,
Leibniz, really.
Right, his rationalism, how that extended to the problem of evil, which I believe Wes read all about. Do you want to fill us in? Or as a high level, before we go into that detail, Candide is just about a guy running around and a lot of crappy stuff happens to him, and his teacher at the beginning of the story was a Leibniz disciple who insisted that this is the best of all possible worlds, and showing by example that that is an unsupportable thesis. So there's a hugely oversimplistic way of reacting to the philosophical content of the book.
So say what the problem of evil is. The problem is that there's a lot of evil in the world, and if God is all-knowing and all-powerful, you would think he would be capable of creating a world without evil or without so much evil. And so it looks like an argument against the existence of God, although at that time it was more an argument about God's nature, whether God was benevolent and all-powerful and so on and so forth. So you can take it either as, well, there must not be a God because God is by definition all-powerful and all-knowing, or you could take an alternative route and say, well, God must have certain limitations because of the existence of evil.
It's also probably worth noting that this subtitle, optimism, that optimism is kind of a popular culture thing. This notion of optimism at the time and this philosophy of Leibniz's is a kind of phenomenon in the 1750s, something like that, as an answer to the question of evil, which is sort of occupying some part of the public consciousness. That the response would be by one of the eminent thinkers, well, this is the best of all possible worlds, and therefore there's got to be compensating factors for whatever evil you have. There's something good to be seen in it, and then therefore you have optimism.
Well, Leibniz's solution is kind of a version of a lot of earlier scholastic thinkers, St. Augustine, for instance, where you can go a number of routes. You can say, well, on the whole, the world is really, really good. It's if you look at the specific parts of the world, you can say, okay, this specific thing that happened is evil and so on and so forth. But if you looked at the big picture, you would see that it's good and actually is the best, because God would be required to pick the best of all possible worlds. So that's basically Leibniz's route. It's a little bit more complicated than that.
It makes a lot of sense to me that Leibniz would want to think about it this way, both because of his universalism and as an inventor of differential calculus and integral calculus, and the inventor of, you know, vis viva, the notion of energy. He wants to take the whole and say the whole is some kind of extreme. And the way in which the individual components of it are behaving, that you have individual evils and individual discrepancies, doesn't matter to the fact that the whole both is one thing that has to have some kind of characteristic, and two, that it is an extremum of some sort. That is, it's the best.
So it's like taking a summation in calculus.
Yes,
you get a much different result than just the individual infinitesimals.
That's right. That's right. You could have an infinite number of numbers that you add and subtract from one another, and you get one. That infinite series will converge to that, and he is one of the people who does a lot of work on these kinds of infinite series. Each of those individual parts don't detract from the fact that there's this one extremum that's utterly perfect. And there's that kind of universalist thinking going on. It also reminded me a little bit of things like Kant's question of the philanthropic right to lie, where he argues that you shouldn't do that, really on the basis of a kind of universal good, that lying just contributes to the lack of goodness in the world. And so there's no justification for doing it. It's the same kind of thing, that you understand each individual, each action, each happening as being radically part of a whole, not individual in its own right.
Yeah, I don't want to jump too much in the book to try to address what Wes just brought up about scholastic history, but at least Voltaire is pretty clearly calling out Leibniz's rationalism and his getting to this conclusion of the best of all possible worlds a priori. He's not thinking that it's Leibniz saying, well, this part might be bad and this part might be bad, but on the whole, it's good. In fact, there's no empirical content whatsoever to Leibniz's assertion, and that's precisely what the book is kind of. Yeah. So in that sense, it's not coming from that same tradition or that same line of thinking anyway that you mentioned.
Yeah, and actually Leibniz's argument is a little bit different from this line of thinking. This is just a simpler way to put it. Leibniz actually has a more sophisticated variation of this. The whole is more than the sum of its evil parts. But it's interesting, you know, the way Voltaire goes at Leibniz and Candide. One of Leibniz's doctrines involves the plenum, which is to say that in the best of all possible worlds, every possibility is actualized. He thinks of possibilities as these things striving to sort of come into being, and they're actually, because of his theory of monads, they're not inconsistent with each other, so they can all be realized. So you mm-hmm. get a, even though there's a simplicity of scientific laws, you get this maximal variety in the world, which is a good thing, including, so for instance, all the variations in forms of species and subspecies. And what's interesting about Candide is you get that sense of a plenum of all this stuff happening, except most of it is bad. It's like he's teasing Leibniz. Yes, every possibility is actualized, but most of the possibilities suck.
Yeah. And listeners who aren't aware, we do have a previous episode on Leibniz that it might be worth your time to go back and listen to, because a lot of the stuff that Leibniz says sounds really crazy until you spend a little time with it, and then you understand that it's
totally awesome.
It's totally awesome.
You smoke a joint and really sit down and appreciate it.
I think it's a significant rhetorical move that Voltaire is not attempting to parse Leibniz's argument, that it's much like my dismissal of slavery in the recent Aristotle episode. This is such an obviously bullshit thing that I'm not going to take your argument and parse it apart, because it's bullshit and it's not worth my time. And that goes into Voltaire's overall eschewal. Is that a word? Eschewal?
Rejection. I've never heard anyone use it, actually.
A rejection of metaphysics. as being more or less a waste of time. There was even something, so he wrote this philosophical dictionary, which has just a lot of little bits and pieces, little tiny essays on a lot of different...
Like
testicles. Yes, we were reading something before we started. He has an entry on testicles.
In his philosophical dictionary.
Yes.
It's more like a funny-sophical dictionary.
One of the things that I was reading about that is, you know, one of the places, I forget what metaphysical topic he's talking about, but it pretty much he stops, says, you know, happily, none of this really matters for our action. You know, which view you have in the metaphysics here is not going to affect your morality either way. And so that's what he was ultimately concerned about. He was, you know, his big objections to Descartes and Leibniz, and this, it was to the intellectual climate that they were creating in France at the time. And he didn't like that. He liked, politically, he was a anti-authoritarian. He was a liberal of some sort. The French Revolution, which, you know, who knows whether he would have approved of that or not, but they considered Voltaire one of their main influences. So he, if you think this is the best of all possible worlds, then it's not a great motivation to go politically to do something to improve things, to get new people in power, etc. That was the main problem, that, you know, he liked Cartesian doubt, for instance, but then thought that Descartes cheated and didn't really even have an argument for God. He kind of did the same thing with Descartes on God in the Philosophical Dictionary that he does to Leibniz here. He doesn't actually go in and, of course, he must have read the Meditations. It's not long. It was a major thing, but he doesn't feel the need to dive in and, like, parse it up, at least that I'm aware of. There are probably folks listening that are more familiar with. Actually, from what I understand, pretty much nobody is, unless you're like a historian of that period, is deeply familiar with the philosophical work of Voltaire, that he's just not one of the guys that's on their radar. But in any case,
what he wrote was plays and poems.
Yes,
and other things.
Yes. And when he did do philosophy, I mean, most of what he did, right, he wrote
hundreds and hundreds of pages,
right,
thousands of pages.
And he wrote Candide in, what, 2 weeks or something, I heard?
Yeah,
or
when he was 65 years old.
Yeah, it was very dashed off.
He wrote more than 20,000 letters, and
he was basically a blogger.
Prolific. Yeah. And yeah, that's what I was, yeah, basically a blogger of his day.
Yeah.
And Dylan, you were mentioning the printing press, you
know, exactly.
It's a new technology, the way the internet is new to us. So.
Right. So, you know, it's not that he took Descartes' arguments, for instance, and parsed them out, and I'm participating in the Philosophical Academy, and this is my objection to my predecessors. Like, he wasn't playing that game. He was taking it from a populist angle and saying, this is pretty obviously bullshit. You know, I approve of the overall skeptical tone. So actually, as a sort of a philosopher as a whole, like, he comes down in, we had a Montaigne episode in the skeptical tradition. And much like Montaigne, you know, one of his big complaints is about people's overestimation of the intellect and really what metaphysicians could, can you really come up with anything? Like, it's not that there's something attractive about the enterprise doing philosophy. It's rich intellectual work, but what you come up with is not necessarily something it's not going to save the world. You don't need to go to the depths that metaphysicians do to tend your garden, yeah, as the book concludes. Mm.
Did you just spoil that?
Did you spoil it.
Spoiler out there.
So skepticism was very influential at this time. They had sort of a revival of, at some point, the work by Sextus Empiricus, an ancient skeptic, had been published, and it's very influential on Descartes and Montaigne, and I think via Descartes and Montaigne on Voltaire. I don't think he was digging deep into the classics necessarily. Well, no, actually, Voltaire had a strong classic education in Latin.
Rich guy.
Yeah.
Grew up rich.
But the point is that for Descartes, skepticism was really methodological. He was trying to get beyond skepticism by using that as a starting point to flesh out these solid foundations that were really going to, where you could erect some structure, which was beyond skepticism. And for Montaigne, and I think for Voltaire, skepticism is really, to some extent, an endpoint that really informs the way you live life.
Yeah, I think in Candide, as both funny and acerbic as it is, there's a real background preoccupation with, well, what does this mean to the way you live your life? And even the things he's making fun of satirically, and the extreme kind of behaviors of the army and the events that happen, to me, point back to him just saying, you know, that is not a very enjoyable way to live, and just being preoccupied with sort of living decently, not even the idea of living well, but just not getting hunted down. That would be a good start.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark said about authority and the authority of someone like Leibniz and Descartes. I have no idea how this factors in with the general period of the time, but it's clear that the level of political authority, both with the church and with politics in general, is so high. You know, people get, you know, kings and princes and bishops get personally offended by something that Voltaire writes, and he feels the need to flee the country. So the way in which authority works at that time is rightly scary, I think, and very to be fought against. And Voltaire works very hard on that. But he also gets burned a lot.
Hmm. I don't know if this is related to that, Dylan, but one thing I made a note of as I was reading through it, there are a number of points where characters in the book or Voltaire as the narrator raise the issue of the law of something. So the law of war dictates that it's okay to do this or that, or the law of whatever. And there's a point to be made about the rational faculty versus other things too. But, you know, he's sort of contrapositioning or contraposing these laws, but all of the laws are, they're man-made laws, right? The law of war, the law of kings, the law of this, the law of authority, the law of the Portuguese that decide they have an auto da fé to prevent an earthquake, right? These are all reasons that are made up by human beings. And in that sense, I think, like you say, Voltaire's explicitly making a loud and conscious reaction to something that is in the structure that human beings create. And somehow that ties into this, the metaphysical law, but I'm not quite exactly sure how.
Maybe he's reacting against the sort of inherent authoritarianism of those metaphysical theories, right? The hierarchies and the foundationalism of Descartes. And arguably, you could see those sorts of things as inherently authoritarian, right? Just trying to establish these absolute fundamental truths and derive the rest, other propositions from that and so on.
Or as being used that way, whether they inherently have it or not, that it's one of the weapons of power.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a priori. I mean, is it, your a priori derivations are sort of reminiscent of, let's say, the bloodlines of kings, that sort of justification for kingly authority, whereas the kind of Newtonian empiricism that he embraces is arguably inherently populist. It's based on evidence, and if the evidence runs against the prevailing authority of some kind or another, then that authority must be dethroned.
Yeah. It seems to me that one of the things that he's doing rhetorically when he says the law of war dictates something, which seems to be against Leibniz's law, right, the best of all possible worlds, he's using this empirical law or this man-made law or something like that. But at the same time, he's also making a point about that law itself, right? About how horrible it is, and obviously through the nature of the characters and so forth. So there's kind of like this double move where he's using it as a critical element and then also simultaneously criticizing it, that I think is what's especially clever. I mean, this is a short, for people who haven't read it, this is one of the ones that's worth going out to read. Sometimes we talk about things that I don't think it's worth you reading. That's why we do what we do. But this one's worth reading because it's short and it's fast and it's nonstop. It's
very
just
funny.
One hit after another.
You could read it instead of watching a movie. You could do it in a couple hours.
Yeah.
Should we give a little plot summary?
Yeah, we should. Starts out with a sex scene.
So, I mean, the plot summary is very simple, right? If the book takes 2 hours, it's Candide, who lives in this castle. He's not the son of the baron of that castle. Is the implication that he's the bastard son of the baron?
He's the bastard son of the baron's sister.
Okay.
Probably.
He grows up in this very cushy little world, and he has this philosophy tutor, Pangloss, who fills him with all sorts of pie-in-the-sky ideas about the world, including this optimism, this best-of-all-possible-worlds idea.
And with that, the principle of sufficient reason that Voltaire makes a joke of several times in the story of on the battlefield, you know, it was the bayonets were sufficient reason for 1,000 heads to be pierced that day, or, you know.
Yeah.
So he falls in love with the daughter of the baron, Cunegonde, and they're caught fooling around, so he gets kicked out of the castle, and then all sorts of horrible things happen to him, basically. That's really...
He goes to war first.
Yeah. So he has lots of traveling, lots of adventures, you know, chapter after chapter with change of scene, and through a lot of it, he's really just trying to find Cunegonde, who he's still in love with, and eventually he does. As the book goes on and he suffers all these hardships, he becomes arguably more realistic, let's say. And then by the end of the book, we get him and Cunegonde and Pangloss and some other compatriots he's picked up along the way living together in Turkey, right?
Outside of Constantinople.
Yeah, outside of Constantinople.
Istanbul.
And the final, you know, the final lesson, they, you know, he goes and asks a dervish. What does he ask the dervish?
He says something like, is this the best of all possible worlds? And doesn't he say something like, it doesn't matter?
And the dervish shuts the door in his face in kind of disgust. And the conclusion, you get this idea that, let's look at the last, maybe we should read some of this since it's such a great
While you're looking that up, I would say that to say that he goes on in some adventures and endures some hardships is kind of an understatement of the...
Yeah, we'll get to some of the details of the...
It's substantially worse than that.
It's not like he has a little bit of...
It's not like The Tempest, where he gets shipwrecked and has to wander around and get fleas bite his ankles or anything like that. It's a little worse than that.
So in the end, Candide says, "I know also," said Candide, "that we must cultivate our garden." And then the whole little group entered into this laudable scheme. Each one began to exercise his talents. The little plot yielded fine crops, and so on and so forth. You get this idea that these people who are kind of crazy and unrealistic have finally developed some sort of realism and the capacity to enjoy their lives, even though what happens throughout the book is not really in their control, right? All this, these terrible things. Of course, that's not the real world either. That's one of the interesting things about the book. It's, you know, Candide is this innocent who's cast out into the world, but it's not realistic. The number of bad things that happened to him, and then all those sorts of reversals, you know, people die, but then they're not really dead. And that happens more than once for more than one character. So in a way, you could take that it's just as an allegory of people who are suffering from a lack of a realistic approach to life, including this optimism. In the end, I don't think what the book is counseling is pessimism.
Well, I remember being, when I read this in high school or whenever it was, an incredibly disappointing philosophical ending that really, you just got to keep at it. And actually, I read it as a private thing, like the social is too big and scary and there's nothing really we can do about it. So you need to tend to your garden, deal with your own stuff. And from some of the things I was listening to and reading to prepare for this, probably we'd want to interpret more in a broadly political manner, that tending to your garden is nearly equivalent translation from the French is something like work the field. It's keep at it, but it's keep trying to remedy these various injustices. And
it sounds like he's suggesting withdrawing from the world to some extent, right? They've been through all these adventures and traveling, and here they are sort of exiles near Constantinople with their own little commune, let's call it. And it sounds like, retreat to the farm, to your commune, and live a simple life. On first blush, I'm not saying that's what it's really saying.
I think there's something about that. Just before where you read, Candide is talking to the Turk, and he says, "You must have a vast and magnificent estate." And the Turk replies, "I have only 20 acres of land, which my children and I cultivate. Our work keeps us free from three great evils, boredom, vice, and poverty." And it's on reflecting about these things as they walk back that Candide decides, well, you know, there's all these kings. They don't seem to be happy in any way. And then this is where two more times this statement of cultivating your garden comes up. So some of it is clearly a little bit of taking care of and tending your own things and maybe a little bit of retreat. But also it has something to do with the notion of work, of occupying yourself in a positive way. Not in an alienating work way, but a...
Tend your cubicle.
Yeah, you're not going to be building pins for a living. Right? But rather, it's so thin there about exactly what the virtue of work would be, but it's clear that you're occupying yourself.
Is it anti-philosophical? It almost sounds...
There's just a little further on. Let's work without theorizing.
There you go. It's anti-philosophical.
It's the only way to make life bearable.
Yeah.
In other words,
don't think too much.
This is the anti-partially examined life text.
If you think too long, you're wrong.
Maybe it's the partially part that he agrees with us. That
he says without theorizing, not always there.
Well, that's the conclusion that Candide comes to. So there's a separate question.
It's the conclusion that Martin comes to.
Martin
is a particular character that won't get to.
He's the pessimist, which is definitely not Voltaire's position.
I don't see him as the pessimist. Well,
a true pessimist.
He's clearly the opposite of Pangloss.
Yeah. He's sort of like Marvin. I kept thinking of Marvin the Martian in the Douglas Adams.
He's the stoic.
Books.
He's not a pessimist. He's a stoic.
Or not Marvin the Martian, but... Marvin the robot.
Well, he's a Manichean, right? Manichean.
Yeah, the world is a great battle between good and evil, and all you have no role in it whatsoever.
It's not that you have no role. You should not be surprised when bad things happen because...
Well, that the force of evil is sort of on par with God and the force of good, and that those two things battle, and it's not like God is ascendant and dominant.
It's Star Wars.
Yes. You got the dark side of the force, and then...
It's Prometheus.
Yes.
I didn't see that. I don't know.
It was terrible.
I know.
I don't know if we're gonna like go through the plot, but
take us through the plot.
We should delve into some of the good moments.
Just to kind of get into it a little bit, so that we have some notion.
Well, can we see more about the attitude toward philosophy before
okay.
we?
Yeah, sure.
There is a 3-page story that I will link people to that a little more directly says what he thinks about this, which is called "Story of a Good Brahmin." There's two characters that are introduced: an old Brahmin, a very wise man of marked intellect and great learning. And he's miserable. He says, "I wish I'd never been born. I've been studying for 40 years. That's 40 years wasted. I teach others and am myself ignorant of everything. Such a state of affairs fills my soul with so much humiliation and disgust that my life is intolerable." And he goes on and on about this. Pretty much that all the philosophical questions that he brings up, it just is despair that there's more and more things that he can't know. And so this makes him miserable. And yet there's this pull that philosophy has upon us. And you can contrast that with an old woman who lived near this guy who I asked her if she'd ever been troubled by the thought that she was ignorant of the nature of her soul. She did not even understand my question. Never in all her life had she reflected for one single moment on one single point of those which tormented the Brahmin. So she has traditional religious beliefs and she's happy. She's ignorant and happy. But then the kicker, page 3 of this, is I put the matter before some philosophers, and they were of my opopinion. Nevertheless, I've told myself 100 times that I should be happy if I were as brainless as my neighbor, yet I do not desire such happiness. So he says he goes and he asks a lot of people that even though we recognize that philosophy is an evil snare, basically, it's not something that we would choose to give up. Blissful ignorance. This is actually an argument used against utilitarianism. The ignorant person might be really happy and have all these pleasures and not be haunted by these other things. But still, that's not what the person who understands both options would actually choose. So it's not just happiness that makes for a fulfilling life or something like that. So to tie that back to this, then he can rag about excessive theorizing and we should just get to work. But really, he's kind of fooling himself. I mean, he clearly by his own life and the amount of time he spent writing about this crap, he was into it.
But he was into it in a less rigorous way, say, than a Leibniz.
There's only so much analysis that he's going to do. And I'm thinking of that in a pretty precise way, that he loses patience with cutting and cutting and cutting and cutting and cutting. And comes a point where he just feels like you've cut it apart, so it's no longer anything that's recognizable in any way. And it's completely pointless to go there. And that's coupled with not feeling despair about that. There's a kind of despair that someone like Pangloss, but Martin maybe reflects, and this notion that you keep going and going and going and going in this metaphysical way to some kind of beginning. You're struck with, well, I have no idea where to go. I've had this kind of either abyss or this wall or this. I can't know this.
Yeah.
And Voltaire thinks that that kind of obsession and frustration is pointless, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we've all experienced it. I mean, it's probably one of the reasons I left grad school. I love philosophy, but when I got into the second literature and into the endless fine distinctions, it began to seem trivial and pointless. You know, it wasn't beautiful. It wasn't what I had gotten into philosophy for. And I thought, what's the point? Why am I wasting my time on this? In philosophy, you're not making money or producing things that are of obvious benefit. And you wonder about how worthwhile it is. And then, you know, the argument that it's going to help you live a better life, which is supposedly what it's supposed to help you do, is just another question. It's questionable.
Philosophy is self-help.
Maybe it would make sense to talk a little bit about how philosophy is employed in the novel, like what people who have the philosophy are using it for and doing. Because if you dial it back to the beginning, and this is in the first couple pages of the book, so I'm not giving anything away if you haven't read it. The main character is Candide, and as we mentioned, he's this bastard son of the sister of this baron in Westphalia, I think is a German. And Pangloss is the court philosopher, but he's the teacher, the instructor of the baron's kids, and Pangloss is Leibniz, as far as the story is concerned. So this is a guy who's getting paid by some rich guy to hang around and teach these kids, and apparently as a side benefit, he gets to fuck the maid. I mean, that pretty much is the best of all possible worlds, right? I mean, if you get right down to it, this guy has no reason for believing.
He had tenure, in other words.
Exactly. He had no reason for thinking otherwise than it was the best of all possible worlds. The danger is that Candide believes that, in other words, it's not Pangloss so much initially who, it's the people that believe what he says. Everybody in the court thinks, oh, well, he's telling the absolute truth because life is so good here. This goes back to the issue about authority and about the practical nature of it. Not so much is the activity good or bad, but how is it being employed to benefit the individual?
Well, I also like the fact that it seems like the best times in the novel are that Candide spends some time philosophizing with Martin, or he spends some time philosophizing with Pangloss, and then Pangloss and Martin and Candide are all philosophizing together. Those are the good times that they're when they get to chat things
they're
up.
Not the good times. You know what they are? They're the time-wasting times. It's always on the long seafaring, for 15 days they had to cross the Atlantic and go from Portugal to Buenos Aires, and all they do is talk, and it's like sort of a side note, like, and for the next 14 days they disputed about something.
And then you have these great moments where something of urgency is happening and Pangloss is still trying to philosophize. So for instance, after the earthquake in Lisbon and Candide is injured, "This earthquake is nothing novel," Pangloss replied. "The city of Lima in South America underwent much of the same sort of tremor." So here he is theorizing about the earthquake. "Nothing is more probable," said Candide, "but for God's sake, a little oil and wine for his injuries." "What do you mean, probable?" replied the philosopher. "I regard the case as proved," ignoring this guy's pleas for help. So I love the comic elements there where Pangloss simply doesn't function in the world and continues to theorize when, you know, when he should be doing something.
Right. And some of the other good jokes in here are when he's trying to give the best possible world explanations or the coherent world for all these horrible things that are happening. So yeah. You know, there's a good character that had helped Candide out, the Anabaptist that gets drowned. And Pangloss says, yes, the Bay of Lisbon had been made on purpose for the Anabaptist to be drowned. Or he's talking about his own, the fact that he has VD. And he's saying, and how this was brought over from the New World. "If Columbus had not in an island of America caught this disease, which contaminates the source of life, frequently even hinders generation, and which is evidently opposed to the great end of nature, we should have neither chocolate nor cochineal." Cochineal is like some kind of insect. I'm not sure I understand. No, but
it's the ground up shell of a beetle from South America.
All right. So we would not have, like, that outweighs the.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, clearly there he's making fun of the hyper-rationalist theory of optimism there. The kind of tortured rationalizations you would make in support of it.
That and the way in which overt theorizing prevents you from action.
Yeah.
And you're right. You can't conceive of characters actually acting in this way, but that's not really the point.
There's a similar kind of way that Voltaire writes the sections talking about violence in the wars as well. He's describing their suffering, but it's all very, very matter of fact. It's just one thing happens after another, and horrible things happen. You know, at one point, one of the characters talks about how they had to get one of their butt cheeks cut off in order for something. And there's all this torture that happens very matter of fact. It's not described in grisly detail. It's just sort of spoken of in the raping and pillagings of the cities. And then there's a rationalization for this. This is just the way that war is conducted. And it's not this optimist theory, but it's satirizing just the way you would talk about war, that, well, of course, you know, if you're going to have a war, then that means you're going to have raping and pillaging and killing of children and stringing them up and all kinds of horrible things. I don't know enough about the history of the wars in the time, but my impression was that that was a live conversation that you're going around. People are saying, well, you know, yeah, it's pretty horrible to have a war and the way they're behaving is despicable. But in fact, you know, actually, that's just the way war is. And you imagine that people say, well, I'm going to go off to war and I'm going to do horrible things and I'm going to come back. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, there's a point that ties into that, Dylan, I think takes it more from the straight descriptive to kind of more the satirical, that it will make a point. The first thing that happens to Candide when he leaves the Baron's castle is he gets conscripted.
That's right.
Into an army by heroes. So these great heroes, and what Candide's really talking about is they're just soldiers.
Yeah.
Right? And the first thing they do is whip him, right, and teach him how to march. And because he made fewer mistakes day on day, he became suddenly an exemplar and was given command of a regiment or something, mm-hmm. I think, at one point. But you know, the way he uses the term heroes to describe guys who abduct wandering people and conscript them into service and then whip them and then basically force them to fight and do all these things you just described.
And then he tries to go for a walk or something, and so he's basically being beaten to death by his regiment for trying to go for a walk. That's the punishment. But he ends up escaping, and the satirical descriptions of the war, you know, he witnesses the results of wars between the Bulgars and the, what is it, Albaras? Anyway, so you get descriptions like, then volleys of musket fire removed from the best of worlds about 9 or 10,000 rascals who were cluttering up its surface.
That's right.
Candide hid himself as best he could while this heroic butchery was going on. So again, you know, you get more satirical use of this word heroic. And then he describes these horrible scenes, so of what the armies have done to villages, dismembering and disemboweling man, woman, and child, basically. And then Candide flees to another, flees to another village. And Candide himself is sort of oblivious. You get the sense that he himself is oblivious to all the suffering. So you get climbing over ruins and stumbling over twitching torsos. Candide finally made his way out of the war area. You don't get a lot of Candide stopping to empathize with the victims of war. He's just sort of got the blinders on, and he's going. Because for him, remember, it still is the best of all possible worlds, and he's still making that rationalization.
I'm just not sure that I can draw the distinction between the character there and just the narrator and the fact that things are glossed over. That there's certain points later, like, where he's decrying slavery and, like, you know, where Candide is being sympathetic.
What, does Candide decry slavery?
Yes, he sees a slave, he sees a guy that has, what, both of his feet are cut off and his hand, something like that.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, what a horrible thing is slavery. And he has a few things like this. Like, he, like you're saying, it's more
that's
so
a point of development, though, for
during
him,
the book that he gets this. But it is more just somebody, one of the things I was listening to, other podcasts I was listening to, was comparing the voice of the narrator as being similar to the voice of this indifferent God that is letting all this suffering take place. That all this stuff is just described, with a lighthearted manner, but it's just the most horrific stuff he could come up with.
The way the Candide character functions is he does change a bit in the story. He changes a bit, but
there's development, yeah.
But he's also kind of a witness along the way, right? I don't know if it's exactly Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or something like that, where you have a character that things are just happening to over and over and over again. And he once in a while contributes to the action, has a kind of a reaction that matters in the plot of the story, but by and large, it's just kind of dragged along through things that happen to him.
Yeah, I think that's right for the first half of the book, right? You get, I looked at this because I thought of exactly this point. I wanted to see, well, does he become a more active character? And it's actually, you get him, it's just one thing after another happening to him, and he's reacting. He's trying to survive. He's trying to, basically survive for the first half of the book. And then you get El Dorado, and his first real decision in the book, the first time he's an active protagonist who's not simply reacting, is to leave El Dorado. And then the second half of the book, you actually get a lot of real decisions by Candide. There's a real difference in the way he is.
That's a great point. There's two things I want to say in response to that. I'm so glad you brought it up. The first is, it's Candide's desire to find Cunegonde that motivates all the action. So he's not reactive in the sense that it's his desire that ultimately is the thing that keeps pulling him from place to place. But there is no inner life. From a narrative perspective, it's all the external narrative, except in this one place, at least that I remember. It's in chapter 9, and it says, it's after Candide kills the Inquisitor and the Jew. And it says, at this moment, the following is what passed in the soul of Candide and how he reasoned. Emphasis on that. If this holy man call in assistance, he will surely have me burnt, and Cunegonde will probably be served in the same manner. He was the cause of my being cruelly whipped. He is my rival, and as I have now begun to kill, I will kill away, for there is no time to hesitate. This reasoning was clear and instantaneous, so that without giving time to the Inquisitor to recover from his surprise, he pierced him through and through and cast him beside the Jew. So what we have is the first, and as far as I know, the only inner narrative that you get is when he basically breaks from this tie to the best of all possible worlds naivete to that line of thinking, which is, once I have killed for the purposes of protecting myself, it makes perfect sense for me to go and continue to kill to preserve myself and those I love, which I theorize is the rationale that underlies what Candide is criticizing in the Laws of War and all this, like, well, it's okay to kill, you know, for all of these other reasons.
But that's a good point. I think he does take charge earlier than El Dorado. That's his first moment where he really takes charge of things and acts instead of simply reacting.
You're right in the sense that even reacting, he's a victim. He's a constant victim throughout the book, a victim of circumstance, a victim of fraud, a victim of oppression, all these sorts of things. And it's not until the second half of the book that he actually takes action to prevent himself from being a victim, when it starts here.
Yeah. Because at first, I mean, he really is just trying to survive. It's one thing after another that's, you know, from getting conscripted and then escaping and then not having any money and basically being beholden to this Anabaptist who takes him in, and the Anabaptist dies. And then there's the getting beaten by the Inquisitor, and Pangloss is hanged. And it's just really amazing how much hardship you can cram into just a few pages. But yeah.
But I like your point, Seth, about his passivity, that even his choosing to leave this, so we haven't talked about, he gets to this paradise El Dorado, which they have some, oh, maybe this is the best of all possible worlds. There's just endless riches and everybody's happy, and the fact that he leaves that on purpose, but he does that because he's driven by this desire, and that is the thing that I was just talking about in the philosophy is bad for us, but yet we can't help it. We're fucked up. And so there's another quote here, this old woman that comes in as a character later who's the one that loses the buttock, who tells this whole story that she was the daughter of a pope and went through all these horrible things, even worse than what...
And loses the buttock so that people can eat it.
Yeah.
In case rape, sodomy, all the rest of the stuff was enough.
Cannibalism.
Yes. But she says, in chapter 12, near the end, 100 times I was at the point of killing myself, but still I loved life. This ridiculous foible is perhaps one of our most fatal characteristics. For is there anything more absurd than to wish to carry continuously a burden which one can always throw down, to detest existence and yet to cling to one's existence? In brief, to caress the serpent which devours us till he has eaten our very heart?
Mm-hmm.
So again, we are filled with contradictions, that Freud would have really liked this. Maybe he...
Yeah, I think this is all... Well, we'll get to that later. No, I mean, I think the question... Coming back to the question of El Dorado, I mean, I think that's important. Like, for me, the two most important questions for this book are, why does he leave El Dorado? And then what does the cultivating the garden mean? I think those two things are related. Because even though, you know, arguably... he's obsessed with Cunegonde, and so he has to, you know, he's in love with her, and he's willing to give up basically what is paradise to pursue her. I think maybe there are other elements at work there, which is that El Dorado is not such an exciting place. And we have a tradition of this in the literature, you know, so Milton's depiction of heaven and Dante's depiction of heaven, they're basically boring places. And one of the things you can't really do in heaven or in a place where, you know, all your satisfactions are there for you, can you really cultivate a garden, or can you really, is there a place for ambition and self-improvement and striving to accomplish something? There's sort of hints that El Dorado is not really the place for that, and that Candide would rather struggle and make something of himself than be stuck in a place which is basically retirement.
Boredom.
And that's where you get the relationship to the end, where, you know, the solution to boredom, is it the dervish who says this?
Yeah.
Yeah. The three evils, boredom, poverty, and...
Vice and poverty. Boredom, vice, and poverty.
Yeah. So the solution is to work, or is to cultivate...
He calls these the three great evils, boredom, vice, and poverty. And except for vice in here is not being a victim of vice, but doing vice, I expect. And poverty here is being a victim of poverty. That would be, of the three, poverty would be the only one that was sort of an evil that Candide encounters himself. That's in that three.
Well, unless he's bored in El Dorado.
Yes.
Mainly
yes,
he's...
Yeah.
Vice, I mean, is he encountering vice in the book? His own vice, or...
Unless that's what gets him thrown out in the first place.
And no.
It doesn't really count.
They even cast it as that it's Cunegonde that instigates making
like
out with him.
Or something like that, right? It's not...
Well, actually, what's interesting, and I wanted to say this when Seth was talking about Pangloss, the side benefits of the maid, because actually Candide observes that. So it's interesting that that's his sort of, you know, the moment before the fall, he observes his tutor, this woman, and then he ends up doing the same thing, basically, mm-hmm. and then gets kicked out because of it. So Pangloss's example, you know, do as I say, not as I do, his example led to all of this ruin, you know, for Candide.
My point about the three great evils was that all these terrible things happen to Candide, but in the three great evils according to the Turk, which I think there's a kind of implicit agreement by Candide at the end about those great evils, it doesn't include torture and being conscripted and stuff like that.
Hmm. Actually, I do need to correct you, Wes. So it's one day Cunegonde, while walking near the castle in a little wood which they called a park, saw between the bushes Dr. Pangloss giving a lesson in experimental natural philosophy to her mother's chambermaid.
Yes.
Okay.
So, yes, it's her. It's not, and then it's not Candide instigates. At all. Yeah, she instigates the...
So he's passive even.
Yeah. She's a great corruptor.
It's Adam and Eve, right? I mean...
Yeah.
There's not much advice from Candide during the book, right? He's not really...
He's a victim.
He's in love with Cunegonde pretty steadfastly. He's willing to marry her, even though she's become ugly at the end. And he's...
Well, it does say how they spent the time on the long sea voyages, both philosophizing and engaging in vigorous masturbation. So there's that.
Do they really?
No, they dive.
Like, I missed that.
I would have noted that somewhere, I think. I have my Kindle set to automatically tag masturbation references.
However, the boredom thing, so it was chapter 25 about the Poco Curante, who's a noble Venetian that they visit. And so just basically that you might think that a lot of the hardship and depression in the novel is caused by all these actual bad things that are going. My house was knocked down by an earthquake and my family members have been torn apart and raped and stuff like that. But even the rich, comfortable people are jaded and decadent and bored. Mm. And so he goes through this list of, you know, they talk to this guy about his books and he rips on Milton and he rips on, and some of this might be actually Voltaire kind of being irreverent about those figures that he's talking about. So it's actually kind of Voltaire talking this way. But still, like, there's... It reminded me of the at least my corrupt college version of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where we do need to have our physical needs met. But then I think in his version, you get to self-actualization. It's like once you get all the basic emotional and physical stuff taken care of, you still want to have the self-actualization. Well, in my view, before I'd even heard of Maslow, was know that there's always more. We're just always going to be miserable because there's just some more crap that you feel like you need to accomplish or that you need to be or some way that you're going to make yourself miserable.
Well, it's the important, I mean, it gets at the importance of work, right? I mean, it really comes back down to you talking about self-actualization. People can't find that deeper satisfaction without actually working.
One of the things about work, especially about tending a garden, is it does have an end in its individual tasks, right? Growing a garden, you would have things you have to do as part of that activity. You plant the seeds, you tend it, you water it, and then you harvest it. And then that is accomplished and you've come to a conclusion with it. You've finished it. You've accomplished something. And you might start it over again. That's what I interpret work to mean in this respect. It's not like what I was making fun of earlier, this kind of a post-industrial revolution, sitting on the line making pins, and you have an infinite string of wire on this side, and you have an infinite size basket over here, and you never actually do anything. It's something like involves ended tasks.
Production.
In which you've produced something. Things, yeah. You fix something, you've produced something, you've added something. It's added value. It's marked.
Added value.
I thought that was the Aristotelian you coming out again.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Explain.
Well, you know, telos, having an end and...
And being at work.
Being at work.
You know,
yes.
And I thought of that phrase. I thought of being at work, being Candide as like a... I had this idea that, again, going back to Mark's point about actualization, is that the sort of active working role is necessary to flourishing and fulfillment. In other words, there's a lot of pain in this book, but the avoidance of pain is not the solution.
And it might even be that it's not about the avoidance of pain. There is no avoidance of pain. That character you were talking about, I can't remember which one it was, that was wealthy and...
Poco curante, which means indifferent. I just looked it up.
It means small, literally small, few cares.
Yeah.
Caring little, yes.
So, you know, this is just...
Few concerns.
In a certain way, he's kind of like the counterexample. So we've gone through, and folks, if you're not going to read it, you should, but the novel takes you from Germany to Portugal to South America, back to France and Paris and Venice, and then to Constantinople.
And then he throws in some other characters that tell backstories that take them other places, just
other
to throw
places.
Those
yes.
Northern Africa. And
yes, exactly. And there's a point at which the character, the old woman, who was the Pope's daughter, says, look around the ship. You know, Cunegonde or somebody is complaining about their state in life. And she says, you think you have a story to tell? It resonated with me because I'm Jewish. It's like, your pain, let me tell you about my pain. Right. And, you know, she tells her story, which is like three times as horrible. And then she says, ask anybody on the ship and they're going to tell you a horror story. And he says, they went around and for the 15 days on the boat, they went and just everybody had a horrible story to tell, right? And it's just bad things happening over and over again. Then you have the counterexample, which is your poco curante. Here's somebody to whom nothing bad has happened. He's all of his wealth intact. He's got none of these cares. And you think, oh, well, this would be somebody who wouldn't have any of these concerns. But you know what? He's not happy either, right? He's not satisfied with anything. It's not good enough. He can't enjoy it. So having pleasure, being free from suffering, isn't a guarantee of enjoyment either. And you're sort of like, so, you know, all of this is kind of leading towards the end of the book where it's not so much about avoiding suffering or gaining wealth or somehow being in some position where you're going to be happy and satisfied. It goes back to being productive, being in a community. There is definitely a communal aspect of it because the dervish talks about his family, and it's important that there's commerce and some weird, you know, like I take my stuff to town and then I hope that kind of thing. This is all important elements of it. So a life of rich idleness is not it. You know, being a victim of these wars and all this stuff is not it.
Yeah, and it doesn't, in pointing out that the life of the wealthy rich guy isn't great, he's also sort of fetishizing suffering or something like that and saying, oh, it's much better to suffer because somehow I feel like I'm really living when I'm suffering. Mm-hmm. He's not going that route either, right? Work is not, well, it's not suffering in the same way.
No, absolutely not.
But, you know, between living in a sort of El Dorado kind of state where you're free of pain, I think that's the implication, and being in a really ridiculously horrible world, but having the chance to cultivate one's garden in that world, I think you take the latter choice. I think that's part of the point.
So you asked the question, well, so one of the two most important questions is, why did he leave El Dorado? Yeah. So a version of that question is that even if he feels compelled to leave by his love of Cunegonde, let's grant that on the face value for a second. Is there a sense of regret about leaving or a sense of relief about leaving? So how much of it is a compulsion?
You know, it's interesting. He never expresses regret, right, about leaving. He never says, oh, I should have stayed in El Dorado.
No.
Yeah.
Even though, I'll spoil the one more thing, that when he finally finds his love, then she's ugly and bitter.
Yeah.
And he marries her.
Ugly inside and out.
Yes. And he says he doesn't even at that point really want to marry her, but does out of a sense of honor.
But she makes good pastries, right?
Yeah. She's
in the end. Yeah. That's what she learns. They all learn something.
Yeah, they all learn.
Once they all figure out that they should stop theorizing and just start working, they all cultivate one skill or another. I want to go back to El Dorado for just a second. Let's say this is Voltaire's empiricist rebuttal or criticism of Leibniz's a priori theory. There's another pretty devastating critique in here that's kind of embedded in the El Dorado story. It's when Candide is with, is it Martin at that point? He's got a couple of... That's another thing. Candide always has a helper or an advisor. Or
he's
somebody.
Got a sidekick.
He's always got a sidekick, yeah. Anyway, there
is... from the ultimate optimist to Martin the pessimist.
Yeah. Well, and Cacambo, I guess.
There was Cacambo, his South American guide. Yeah, it's with Cacambo. They're in El Dorado, which is this... By the way, there's a little mini utopian novel embedded in this thing as well. I mean, there's a lot going on. This is like the Euthyphro of French literature. And they're questioning this wise old man in El Dorado, and they say, what's the religion? And the man gets angry and says, what do you mean? Can there be two religions? There's just the one. We worship God night and morning. And he says, but, well, do you worship one God or many? And the guy says... Surely there are not two or three or four. What you is that the world is a strange place you come from that you ask these questions. And so Candide says, well, how do you pray to him? And the old man says, we don't pray to him. We have nothing to ask of him. He has given us all that we need, and we return him thanks without ceasing. To me, that's actually like a very interesting, and if in fact we lived in the best of all possible worlds, and this was because God was so good, right? Then there would be no point in asking him to give you anything. You would just essentially be grateful all the time that you lived in the best of all possible worlds. And I think that's actually a pretty strong criticism, but probably a poke at Leibniz. Like, what's the point of religion if you live in the best of all possible worlds decreed by God? All you could do is thank him for putting you in that position. There'd be no reason to pray for anything.
Would there not be sport? They're not being... I pray to... Well, sure, I'll get the gold.
All those pro basketball players would have to... We'd all have to be like them. First of all, I want to thank Jesus for the victory, right? All those athletes that do that. But I thought that was a really nice little subtlety that was kind of stuck in there. Anyway, just want to throw that out.
It was such a good point that I will come over there and express my affection.
Let's edit that out.
No.
Mark has probably a whole list of predetermined. Now that we're all in the same place, I can... He's got little bits he's ready to run.
This is not planned. I'm going to come over there and tickle your fancy if you don't.
Spontaneous outburst of affection. Don't think I don't appreciate it. All right.
He doesn't regret leaving El Dorado. So is leaving because of Cunegonde a thin excuse, or is it actually driving him? I wonder about this through the whole novel, the extent to which he was genuinely driven by Cunegonde, yeah, or whether he's driven by something else.
I think it's both, because I think, in a way, rather than simply being an argument against optimism, it's an argument against living in a fantasy world where you've idealized things. It's against idealization. And at that point, he's operating on this idealized version of Cunegonde. Who is she but a childhood love who he knows is very beautiful? It's superficial. So, in a sense, that's what he's still pursuing. But at the end, where he's willing to continue this relationship and commit to it, let's say, despite the fact that she's no longer fits the ideal in certain ways, is no longer the beautiful young girl, that's the authentic relationship to another human being, which isn't simply all good, isn't simply the best of all possible worlds, but is a mixture of good and bad. And that's, I think, what you get at the end. It's a rejection of idealization. And in a way, I mean, I think the argument is that when you live in that, with that sort of propensity to idealization, you're set up for the world seeming as terrible as it is in this book, right? Yeah. I mean, even if you aren't being beaten and hanged and all these other things, the world might end up seeming that bad by comparison to your ridiculous expectations. So in the end, I think it's basic maturing where you... To mature is to give up these idealizations, basically.
This is the way I've always felt about nihilism. Is I've always felt like it was a hyperreaction against excessive metaphysics. I wouldn't have said it that way, but that's the way I've always felt like that. If the extent to which you would actually succumb to nihilism is a result of a overexcited expectation about what you ought to get.
And you're still fundamentally an optimist. It's just... You're a disappointed optimist.
Yes, yes. A nihilist is really just a disappointed metaphysician, a prior metaphysician. They really expect it to all be the case, and then they're utterly disappointed and inconsolable, and they can't help themselves from just banging their head against the wall over and over and over again.
So there's a pragmatist kind of strain in this, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anything good, I find to be pragmatist.
And when we say pragmatist strain, it means, going back to our pragmatism episode and William James, part of the idea is that you give up the idea of getting to the thing in itself. That's the version of the ideal, or that's the optimist's objective at the metaphysical level, is communion with the thing in itself. And that's the thing you have to give up as, let's say, a mature pragmatist, which doesn't mean that you give up the notion of truth. You have a more revised, limited notion of truth. It's a muddied notion because the human mind, the constructive activity of the human mind is always implicated in the object now, instead of getting this perfect mind-independent object. So that's the parallel that I see.
Yeah, sure. Hmm.
There's a lot of social criticism in this book, and I'm wondering to what extent you guys feel like, I keep wanting to say Candide, Voltaire is... tying the criticism to that metaphysical notion that we started off the discussion with, and how much he's using a satirical or ironic way of using that term. There's a lot of places in the book where he says, for example, the small group of rich people have the money and the poor people have nothing, because that's perfect justice, right? And perfect this. And there's a really kind of poignant passage after Candide leaves El Dorado with Cacambo. They come across a slave lying in the road, and the slave is missing a leg and a hand. And they ask him, "How did you come to this state?" And he says, "This is the price at which you eat sugar in Europe." Mm. and he tells his story of being sold into slavery, right? And all of these things seem to indicate a kind of criticism of the social order, of the economic order, of the political order, that's kind of underwritten by this idealism that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And getting back to the idea that, is he just simply being a satirical critic, or is he advocating for some sort of reform? I don't know if he is. I don't know if he isn't. But I wondered if you think that his criticism is fundamentally tied to believing that there's a rationalist structure that informs all of these institutions and has made this practice the case, or if he's just using it rhetorically. You get what I'm asking? Wes is nodding his head. Which is the first time that's ever been. First time well, I can ever say that on this podcast.
Being able to see my head.
That's right.
At this point. Yeah, you're asking if the social criticism of these institutions parallels the criticism of rationalist metaphysics, let's say, because one supports the other, or one is implicated in the other.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't remember the quote, but I mean, when Pangloss and Martin are together and they're contrasting their views, and it's, is it the best of all possible worlds, or is human nature fundamentally corrupt? But that's the problem, is that human nature is basically fucked up, and there's nothing that sounds like rationalism about that to me.
Okay. I mean, I guess the way I was thinking was, if you take this best of all possible worlds and this a priori rationalist metaphysics that he's, you know, dressing Leibniz up as, and saying, this is the kind of thinking that underwrites monarchy. This is the kind of thinking that underwrites imperialism. This is the kind of thinking that underwrites the violence that peoples perpetrate on each other.
That gets back to the idea that his big target is a kind of authoritarianism. And the authoritarianism involved in the kind of intellectual enterprise. Now, you're asking a harder question, which is there a deeper relationship between the kind of authoritarianism in imperialism or monarchy and the kind of metaphysics that Leibniz is going after, or idealism?
I think you could easily make the case that there is. The authority of the monarch through the divine right of kings, you know, the authority of the church through the goodness of this, the authority of the European powers to have over.
Yeah.
There's a way of telling that story where I think you can make that case.
That's an a priori kind of authority that rests in bloodlines. You don't, the analogous evidence there is elections and the test of public conferral of authority. That's simply there before anyone gets to say anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you could argue that, I think that there are parallels between a priori reasoning, let's say, and then authoritarianism in these political structures.
From what I understand, Voltaire was not a big fan, actually, of democracy either.
No, I know. He was a fan of the English constitutional monarchy at the time. What he's not a fan of is what's going on in France, right, which is what will lead to the French Revolution, which is extreme abuses of authority, which the French monarchs get themselves in big trouble with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, England, he was sort of exiled himself to England for a while. As we mentioned before, this type of thing was happening all the time because he was offending people by what he was writing. But it was there that he, you know, he got to know Shakespeare and Locke and Newton and all these influences, which ended up being subversive, and he brought back with him to France.
It doesn't seem like he's a populist or a democratic populist or something like that. But I feel like we should be able to say more clearly what it is about authority or abuse of authority. Maybe it's just as simple as that, abuse of authority, that he so despises. There's a kind of inconsistency and hypocrisy that he finds incredibly offensive. And he also clearly likes pointing it out in other people and institutions.
And obviously, the whole idea of the, you know, this is the best of all possible worlds is like the rationalization to which Marx objects. It's this is the way things are, and this is the way they're meant to be. You know, we're in this class, and whether you justify it by divine right or bloodline, or this is the way society must be structured, it's a kind of necessity. You could even give it a scientific justification, right? And just say, this is the way the world is organized, and there's nothing you can do about it.
There's a way to think about this, Dylan, in the sense that what the authority structure does in the book, and this is kind of the behavior when you talk about it, those who benefit from the status quo seek to perpetuate it. And so authority is just the movement, it's power exercised by those who want to maintain the status quo because it benefits them in a certain way. And sometimes you do it passively and sometimes you do it actively.
So take, for example, with our our system, look at the way people glorify capitalism. It's not enough to say, yeah, it's okay, it has its drawbacks, and we need a safety net, and we sort of have to take this complex, nuanced view where we acknowledge the good and the bad. You have this sort of hyper-reactive, almost religious approach to capitalism, where capitalism is sort of the American religion. That's the sort of idealizing capitalism and failing to, and saying, you know, this is the best of all possible worlds, and failing to look at the real negative consequences. In other words, this best of all possible worlds argument is a very dangerous one. That it's not like this is just a little artifact of Voltaire's time. I think you see it historically in any society. Like, you know, Seth mentioned, it's one of the ways of maintaining the status quo. It's one of the ways that people in power can keep themselves in power. You idealize a certain system and try and get people to ignore the bad. And there's a cult of optimism, I think, in various elements of our own society, you know.
I get what you're saying in terms of the complacency that we so feel like we have at least the outlines of the best system of government, for instance, figured out, that we will not admit problems that we can't think of a solution for readily. So the one that I always bring up is just, why do so many people have shitty, meaningless jobs that they hate?
Yeah.
Somehow, no, that's just, that's the best.
That's the American dream.
Right. It's built into the system. Or, you know, why is there the percentage of unemployed there is, or, you know, something like that. That's going to be a byproduct of this best possible system, that there's no way that we could possibly deal with these underlying, with these flaws.
That line of argument happens frequently in lots of contexts.
The position of the loyal opposition is very difficult in any situation that where people have authority. It's very, very hard. And it requires all parties, for that to be successful, it requires a basically cooperative disposition by all the members in the conversation in order for that to work. There have been times in, I think, in American history that our political climate has supported something like loyal opposition. It's hard right now, at least at the highest levels.
I want to say one thing in favor of Candide. He's really a not particularly envious character throughout most of the... Voltaire kind of challenges you to sympathize with him because of all of the things that are visited upon him, but he's not a terribly sympathetic character because of his passivity, because of his naivete. And it occurs to me that there's the moment where he says he renounces the optimism. Do you guys remember? He says, "Oh, Pangloss, I finally renounce your optimism."
That's with the slave,
slave. Yeah.
Chapter 19.
Yep. So it's after he hears the story of the slave that he meets with the no leg and no hand. And the guy tells him about how his parents sold him into slavery to give themselves a better life without regard to him having a good life. And basically just how terrible his life was, right? That's when Candide says, "I could never have guessed at this abomination. In the end, I must at last renounce thy optimism."
Just read Cacambo's response.
And Cacambo says, "What is this optimism?" said Cacambo.
In my translation, it's just, "What's optimism?" said Cacambo.
"What's optimism?"
Yep.
"What is this thing you call optimism?"
I love that.
Apparently, that's not quite as weird that at the point, even though that's a very common word for us now, it was like a piece of technical jargon.
Really?
It was a new word back then.
Yes. Yeah. Interesting.
Like in the 20 years before the book was written.
Yeah. That's what I meant by it being kind of also part of the public discourse. Uh-huh. It was like a new thing.
But the irony there is real because, you know, obviously the implication is Cacambo is better off for never having heard of optimism,
yes,
right?
Exactly. But what's also really interesting about this is Candide's moment of awareness where he finally says, "Oh my God, this whole thing I believed for so long is wrong," doesn't come at the hands of his own suffering. It's when he feels compassion for another. And that kind of speaks to his favor, I think, to his credit mm-hmm. as a character. You might say, well, he's a stupid and whatever for suffering all the slings and arrows of misfortune. But here he truly shows compassion and he learns something. There's a change in him based on that experience. The book closes, for those who aren't going to take the time to read it, spoiler. You know, we talk about him marrying Cunegonde, even though she's ugly inside and out and all this. And even after all of these things that happen, her brother thinks that Candide is not good enough because he's not born of the social caste and doesn't, after they've lost everything, their barony exists no more. People are, there's no relevance anymore to their birth status. It doesn't exist. And yet the brother still is.
But also he misses it by one, what do they call it? He has only 71 quarterings, and she has 72.
Yeah.
71 quarterings means basically that they're genealogical divisions, and then 71 is enormous. It means you basically, your royal blood goes back thousands of years. So hers goes back just a few years more.
Yeah.
But they both have thousands of years of royal blood, but therefore he's not good enough
for her. He's not good enough for her. And Candide basically just says, they put him on a boat. They basically sell him back into slavery. He's like,
yeah.
I'm not
well, the first time he
anymore.
Killed him, so.
The first time he killed him. And this time was a little worse. But and the point is, he's just like, instead of being, oh, woe is me and submitting to this, he takes action against it. So there's something to be said in favor of him as a character, even though.
It's a little harsh to put the brother back into slavery, essentially.
That's true.
Rowing on the ship. Yeah.
Well, maybe that says something about him becoming the perpetrator as opposed to the victim. That's
yeah.
No better either.
Well, the brother didn't have to be taken care of.
An inappropriate response to that objection. Maybe a little heavy-handed.
Well, the way things are going, they'll run into him at some point in the future anyway.
So. That's right. In the sequel.
Yeah. Actually, there was a sequel.
Apparently many
there
of
were
them.
Many sequels, yeah. And, but he didn't write them.
Yeah.
Right.
And I guess it was published anonymously in the first place, and he would, like, write about it as if it was somebody else's work. So that when he denied having written the sequels,
no one believed
him. Do that again.
So it's time for Candide number 3. Seth, are you up to it?
There are ones written. I'll send a link to folks. There's the New York Public Library put on a colloquium about this that you can hear online as a podcast, and they talk a little bit about the various sequels and some set in modern times and going in Rwanda or some other horrible parts of the world as parts of the action, that this stuff is still... I mean, one of the things I keep kicking around in my mind as I've been going through this is how well this relates to modern day issues and whether I even care. You know, if the main call to social action is we shouldn't have totalitarian states and things like that, well, okay, that's still going on in parts of the world, but it's not a live philosophical issue in the way it was in his time, where absolute monarchy was the norm, maybe, I don't know. So something could be a successful social commentary, but not really have much in the way of philosophical content that is live issues that, oh, it makes you think whether, you know, slavery really is bad or not. You know, at the time, this was a big deal. He was one of the first people that actually came out against slavery as part of, I guess it was 20 years after that England outlawed the slave trade. And that was like the first big blow against it as a force in Europe. But then at the same time, I hear what you guys are saying, and obviously these people that are writing the modern day sequels, they can draw plenty of parallels to the fact that there's still evil in the world and life is still suffering more often than not in the way all the Buddhists would complain about, etc. So I'm just not sure. I don't feel like personally I am taking a lot away from this, but it feels kind of nice to fill in the history, and it's a fun story. And if you want to know, going back to an issue raised on our humor episode, how to have a successful rape joke is to put it next to a disemboweling joke and some other horrible murder jokes. And then the whole thing is kind of jokey. It's not specifically a rape joke, but, you know, there's a buttock eating joke. So there you go.
Well, I'm not sure how to follow that. So if I hear what you're saying, Mark, you're saying that in this book, he's criticizing institutions and activities that at the time were not taken for being bad.
Obviously bad.
Obviously bad. And that now if we just say, you know what? War is obviously bad. Monarchy is obviously bad. Imperialism and the slave trade are obviously bad. So his criticisms of them don't carry as much weight. My initial reaction to that is, well, and yet the behaviors continue, right? And so maybe the fact that we rationally acknowledge we've now gone away from the a priori best of all possible worlds, and now we rationally have obviously we have human rights. It's obviously wrong to conscript children in Rwanda and make them fight at 13 and hack people's limbs off. He might say, there's reason, again, doing nothing, being completely ineffectual and creating this idealized, you know, creating people who are distanced from the actual suffering, the actual activity, and taking no action and watching as people drown and watching as the ship. So I think there's still something to that criticism, if you take it that way.
It's unclear to me whether he's advocating, you know, become a fighter for justice, even though that's really what he was in his life, right? He was very Voltaire wasn't basically an activist, and he was concerned about things like free speech and abuses of authority and so on and so forth. But it's unclear to me that you get that out of this, out of Candide, because it looks almost like he's advocating this sort of withdrawal in the end. But I think what's clear is that it is more than being against optimism. Again, it's what he's targeting is this tendency to idealize, to have these very unrealistic expectations of the world. And you had mentioned Freud and how Freud would like this. And I think you're right. You can give this a psychoanalytic reading. You could treat it as a parable of, say, human psychological development. So, for instance, the theory of primitive mental states is that they're a sort of alternation between idealization of the object, the love object, usually the mother early on, and catastrophizing it and being paranoid and feeling persecuted. So you get this very schizophrenic, psychotic alternation between this pure ideal that you must have, you know, the Candide's naivety juxtaposed with the horrible, horrible things that are actually going on. And the reality is actually quite different, that despite the fact that there are wars and horrible things going on in the world, that's not really the reality. And again, the amount of misfortune that Candide experiences isn't really realistic. But the reality is actually the synthesis of those two things. The early stage is what a psychologist might call splitting into pure good and pure bad. And then the mature stage is the synthesis of good and bad, which is accomplished through empathy. And you had mentioned empathy. Mm-hmm. So by empathizing, you get to see other human beings as having their own subjectivity and being mixtures of good and bad. And that's what I think we get in the very end, this synthesis of this radical split between good and bad that you see throughout the book. And cultivating one's garden, I think, has to do with this realistic acknowledgement that this mature relationship to the world isn't this purely ecstatic, best of all possible world state. And it's not simply this horrible, I'm having limbs hacked off state. It's something in between that can be satisfying, but involves one's own work.
I came away with a lot of very similar point of view. And the part that I spent most of the time thinking about was just the end, about what the Zen relationship with work was for Candide. But I don't have anything really more to say than what Wes said about it.
Next time, we are going to continue on this fiction kick with Cormac McCarthy's 2005 novel, No Country for Old Men. And maybe as part of our discussion there, we'll actually talk about how effective fiction is as a vehicle for conveying philosophy. Although it's much less clear in the case of McCarthy that that's actually what he's trying to do, as opposed to just him being a fucking weirdo. Whereas Voltaire was, you know, wrote philosophy on the side. As far as I know, McCarthy does not have a pocket philosophical dictionary that you can...
I'm glad we're having Eric on as a guest, Mark, because you've been very skeptical about this kind of thing, literature being a vehicle for philosophical reflection,
yes,
even if it's not a philosopher.
Tell us about the guest.
Eric Petrie will be our guest. He's a professor at James Madison College at Michigan State University. I know him from when I was an undergrad. I had him for a class when he was his very first year as a professor there. He was working on his dissertation on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics at the time.
And so he had an essay that he presented on this, which is exactly why we're covering it.
Yes. He has been teaching writing, among other things. His background's in political philosophy, but been teaching writing at James Madison, and he's been using this novel, among others. And he'd been thinking a lot about it in terms of Nietzsche and Kant and thinking about philosophy. And he gave a couple lectures about it.
Fantastic.
Hey, we are supported by your donations. If you enjoy this thing we do and want it to continue, please go to our homepage and look for the little donate button. Recent big donors include Peter Forbes, Christian Patino, Kenneth Daly, Thoreau Bartman, David Ramsey, Michael Rissman, and Andrew Knott. With a special thanks to Martin Dempsey for his frequent and repeated donations.
Help us get advertisers. We need you to take a brief or not so brief survey. There's a link to it on the site, and it's required for us to for the new advertising network that we're trying to use. I know we asked for this before, but we changed networks. So,
thanks, guys. It was a special pleasure to have you here in my fetid
dungeon,
spiderweb filled, cluttered basement.
It puts the lotion on its skin.
Yes, help us, because I don't know if we're ever going to get out of here. If you're listening to this podcast and...
if there's never another episode of PEL, look in Mark's backyard.
Yeah. I hardly think a clutter of books and CDs and instruments reaching to the ceiling is the same thing as a serial killer basement.
Well, it's the huge, all the torture devices over there in the corner.
Oh, now we're going to start making shit up. Oh, is that how it's going to work?
There's nothing made up about the fact that I'm sitting next to a roll of duct tape. I'm just going
to... we have a Facebook group you should join. You should go on partiallyexaminedlife.com and participate in the damn discussions. Why don't you do that?
Follow us on Twitter.
PartiallyXLife on Twitter.
And... close the toilet seat after you use it. I don't know. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
I brought my little Principia. Would you like to see it?
Stop me and kiss you to the sky.